wildlife management might want to reduce the hunting season, but they can't unless they exert predator control.
Criticism for the state's predator control program. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a major landmark in Bethel comes down.
I never went inside and climbed it. And I know, you know, other people that have, and lucky them, by golly.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Intensive management, or lethal predator control, of bears and wolves is mandated by a 1994 law adopted by the state legislature. But the authors of an article in the August issue of the Journal of Wildlife Management say the state isn't doing the research necessary to know if it's causing long-term, perhaps even permanent damage to Alaska's grizzly bear population. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
John Shane is co-author of Trends in Intensive Management of Alaska's Grizzly Bears from 1980 to 2010. He's a retired biologist who used his PhD in wildlife ecology to work for 20 years at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, then at the Audubon Society, and as a University of Alaska associate professor. He says one of the problems with the state's intensive management regime is it restricts game managers. For instance, he says caribou or moose numbers may drop due to overharvesting, habitat destruction, or a hard winter. But in the parts of the state where the intensive management program applies, he says managers have few options.
Wildlife management at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, for example, might want to reduce the bag limits, or they might want to reduce the hunting season, but they can't unless they exert predator control.
The state has set goals for moose and caribou populations that many scientists say are unrealistically high. Shane says the state has set grizzly bear population goals too low. For instance, he says the state's goal for the bear population in a game management unit near Glen Allen is only 30% of the number of bears that were there years ago.
The population goal for that area, which has had liberalized hunting regulations, is to have 350 bears. Based on past population estimates, where there was a lot of work and money spent doing population estimates, 350 would be a 70% decline from what they once knew the population was estimated at.
Shane says grizzly bears in interior Alaska are at risk in part due to their slow rate of reproduction. He says deer, moose, and caribou have one or two offspring every year starting at age two or three, but grizzlies only have young every third year starting at age six or seven.
Brown grizzly bears, same species, refer to grizzly bears as the northern interior populations and brown bear as the coastal populations. They have one of the lowest reproductive rates of any land mammal in North America.
Shane says the state is operating under the assumption that fewer grizzly bears means more moose and caribou, even though scientific study results are mixed. Plus, Shane says the state doesn't know enough about the effects intensive management is having on the grizzly bear population in interior Alaska.
The amount of research declined. So we know that harvest increased. We don't know what the effect that has had on population size.
State Division of Wildlife Conservation Director Corey Rossi says the department can't pinpoint population counts within 1 or 2 percentage points, but can track trends and is working to improve.
Specifically, we're spending time and money trying to learn how to better assess populations, and there is some population work going on, of course. With bears in general. Some of the work has been lumped with multiple species, black and grizzly bears, as well as wolves together in some of these predator control areas.
Rossi says it's important to remember that the Alaska Department of Fish and Game manages for multiple uses, and usually, he says, there are enough bears for multiple uses. However, Rossi says any time you legislate wildlife management, there is a risk of some issues in implementation.
Now, could some wording be changed a little bit to maybe clear up or clarify a few things? That's probably not a bad idea, but that's really the legislature's prerogative and the people's prerogative to go to their legislators with that. But as far as the act itself, the statute itself, I don't really have a problem with it.
In 1997, then Governor Tony Knowles asked the National Research Council to take a look at predator control in Alaska. The council recommended the state undertake a rigorous scientific research and monitoring program. Rossi says that's his goal, too.
We are going to continue to strive for the best research program that we can, that we can afford and that we can assemble in terms of a team. And we intend to use that research to inform the process as we make our management decisions.
The Department of Fish and Game has gone to court against the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Fish and Wildlife blocked a state decision to begin predator control in a wildlife refuge in Alaska, saying it's contrary to the purpose of the refuge. Last year, the National Park Service banned certain hunting practices in a handful of parks and preserves, including Yukon Charlie, where the agency says predator control contributed to a 46% decline in wolf numbers in less than a year. The state says wildlife management is a state's right and these federal actions are a challenge to its sovereignty. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Residents in Bethel have lost a major landmark. On Friday afternoon, the Civil Engineer Corps brought down the White Alice radar. The radar towered over the city and much of the low-lying region before it came crashing down. Shane Iverson from member station KYUK in Bethel takes us there.
A very small crowd has gathered on one of Bethel's highest hills. We're mainly local media, but a few other residents are glaring up at the towering tropospheric antenna.
We're figuring she's 60 foot tall.
That's 60 feet?
Yes.
Really? Looks like 300.
Sounding surprised here is Mark Springer. He recalls a bit of the tower's history. The last of six at this site, this 60-footer served as a Cold War radar in the 60s and 70s. For brave locals, scaling the tower is a rite of passage with an amazing view.
I never went inside and climbed it. I should have. My daughter did this summer. And I know, other people that have, and lucky them, by golly.
The graffiti and some other colorful items left discarded show that the tower is a frequent location for people that want to hang out, or loiter, or trespass, depending on how you view things. The Air Force says White Alice is simply too large of a liability to leave standing anymore. The presence of the toxic chemical galbestos has complicated a land transfer to anyone else. Now the demolition crew is ready to bring her down.
Maybe a little slacker, a wee bit.
Two workers are wrapping heavy chains around the tower's posts. Most of the posts have been cut out. Only two remain on this side.
Bob Lopez, I'm the project manager out here in the field.
Lopez says this crew travels the state. Bringing down White Alice antennas is what they do.
Well, something like this, the adrenaline starts to pump a little bit. You're trying to go back in your mind, make sure you hit all your bases, make sure you cut everything that you need to cut, make sure everything's ready to go to bring it down.
There's no explosions here. Instead, the tower posts have been hacked on one side. Guys in tractors are on the other side, some right at the base of the tower, and they will manually be pushing it over.
Strategy basically is to hook up to the tower itself with the cable. We'll pull it forward with the dozer, and we'll use our rest of the equipment to kind of give it a little bit of lift and help topple it over on its face.
Ready?
Ready.
The tractors begin pulling and the chains tense up. The tower crashes down on its rear posts and then lists forward. And that's it. White Alice has been taken down.
Lockdown, buddy.
White Alice stood over Bethel's skyline for over half a century. Lopez says most of the tower is still sturdy, but deterioration was advanced in the concrete posts holding it up.
I mean, if the deterioration keeps escalating the way it has, where it's fractured and alligator and stuff like that, I mean, we can go around there and just start picking it off with your fingers. It wouldn't last much longer. It would have come down on its own.
The demolition crew will now dismantle the tower. Some of it will head to the Bethel dump. The galbestos-plated panels will be shipped downstate to a hazardous landfill. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Petersburg volunteers free a whale from unusual-looking fishing gear.
Some speculation that it's possible it could have dragged it all the way up from Mexico.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation. And by
the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, celebrating 7 years of educating Alaskans on clean, local, sustainable, renewable energy. Find out more online at realaska.org.
A team of volunteers from Petersburg freed a young gray whale that was tangled in what appeared to be foreign gillnet gear on Friday. The animal was 20 to 25 feet long and looked to be in bad shape, but rescuers are hopeful it will at least be able to feed again now that it's no longer entangled. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
The gray whale was originally reported in Ideal Cove, about 15 miles south of Petersburg. The disentangled team left the harbor Friday morning, ready to head out to Frederick Sound aboard Barry Bracken's vessel, Island Dream. But they didn't have to go far. Almost immediately, Bracken says they spotted the whale in the Wrangell Narrows, right in front of town.
As we were leaving the harbor, happened to look over toward Saspe Island there, and they're right in front of Doc Sprague's place. Saw the what I thought was a gray whale blow, and I said, well, that's strange. And so we drifted for a while, and sure enough, and it fit the description of the animal we were looking for, so we didn't have to go looking for it. It came looking for us, I guess.
The team included Bracken, Don Holmes, and Sonny Rice, who are all board members of the Petersburg Marine Mammal Center, as well as local fisherman Bob Martin. They're all trained to respond to tangled whales as part of the Alaska Marine Mammal Stranding Network. Working from a skiff, they were eventually able to get a carabiner in line, called a control line, attached to the gear trailing from the whale's tail. By this time, the animal had traveled a few miles down the narrows to Scow Bay.
The gear itself was very, very close to the fluke, but it was also trailing a huge, huge mass of kelp. And by the time we got that cut off, we figured that was probably over 200 pounds of kelp that it was dragging behind the gear itself. It was all entangled in a big wad. And so anyway, got part of the gear off, lost the control line several times, reattached.
Rice and Martin were finally able to cut the massive gear off at around 2:30 in the afternoon near Mountain Point. Bracken says the whale was emaciated and had injuries to its tail, but at least it was free of gear when it swam away.
It's probably between 22, 25 feet long, so it's a relatively small whale. And generally, they're kind of a charcoal gray with white patches on them. This one is almost, because of the amount of whale lice and barnacles, almost looks more a creamy brown color, not a healthy animal.
Bracken, who is a retired fisheries biologist, says the fishing gear they recovered was not anything that's used in Alaska.
It's kind of almost a burgundy pink monofilament gillnet with some really interesting cork and lead line. And it's a full 9-inch stretch mesh, which would be fishing for some type of a large type of fish. And the way it's rigged, it might have even been used as a sunken gill net. And I was talking to National Marine Fisheries Service about it, and some speculation that it's possible it could have dragged it all the way up from Mexico.
Bracken's not sure how the whale will do, but he's glad at least it now has a chance. While gray whales are occasionally spotted in southeast, it's not their usual habitat. Bracken says the majority breeds off Mexico and calves in the lagoons of the Pacific shore of Baja. He says they swim 5,500 miles to the Chukchi Sea to feed, the longest mammalian migration on Earth. They feed on the bottom, dredging broad, soft, shallow areas for worms, mollusks, and crustaceans. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
A group in Delta Junction is working to establish a hospital to help area residents who currently have to travel to Fairbanks or Anchorage for treatment. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
More than 50 people met Thursday night at Delta City Hall to hear the case for a hospital in the community. Heading up the effort is Mary Caspari, a registered nurse at the Family Medical Center in Delta, who, along with six other area residents, has formed the Interior Alaska Hospital Foundation. Caspari says she's been working on the idea since May after talking with a colleague at the clinic, Dr. Norman Petty, who'd recently come to Delta from a small town in Wyoming.
We were on call one Saturday together and we started talking, and he had made mention that he reopened a small community hospital in Lusk, Wyoming, and he was surprised that we did not have a community hospital here because we were seeing probably 3 times the amount of patients here in this community that they saw in Lusk, Wyoming.
Caspari says that conversation helped her realize the obvious need for a hospital. The area's population now exceeds 5,000, and the volume of patients treated at the clinic has tripled over the past 10 years, sometimes reaching 1,200 a month. Caspari says the Delta Clinic probably serves somewhere closer to 8,000 people because many come from all around the interior. That's because there are no hospitals anywhere between Fairbanks, Anchorage, and the Canadian border. Bob Brummond, a former hospital administrator from Montana who specializes in small hospital finances and who's working with the foundation, says he thinks Delta can make a strong case for a hospital.
You know, it just looks very promising here, and especially with the fact that there's not anything else within 100 miles of this facility.
Caspari says the patients treated at Delta's clinic come in all kinds, requiring everything from routine to emergency care. The most seriously injured are transported to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital and hospitals in Anchorage, but Caspari says there are more than enough mishaps to keep the Delta clinic busy.
Accidents, plane crashes, spring and summer, a lot of ATV problems, a lot of ATV accidents that we ship out. Wintertime, snow machines, then we have the, you know, hit the moose, you know, and get cracked up. There is a lot. It's amazing what goes through that clinic.
Because the area's population is growing older, there's also a need for services to treat that age group. Caspari cites a recent state study that estimated Alaska's senior population will double between 2008 and 2018. Caspari says before the initiative can move forward, the foundation must contract for a feasibility study to outline the area's demographics and the need for each age group and how to go about addressing those needs, how big of a hospital is needed. The study also will propose funding sources for construction and operation of the facility. Caspari says the foundation is in the process of raising $50,000 to pay for the feasibility study. Foundation members have asked the city for half that amount, and council members are considering the request. The foundation has set up an account at the local Wells Fargo bank branch for donations. Meanwhile, Caspari says the foundation is moving ahead. 3 consulting companies are expected to submit proposals for the feasibility study by the end of the month. She says if all goes well, the study should be completed by the end of the year and that the foundation can begin the new year with an announcement that the hospital is a go.
And then bring the new year in doing the certificate of need, complete that within 6 months and get it to the state. And I don't see why we couldn't dig dirt by 2013.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
Late last week, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission was in Dillingham to visit a project that will bring broadband internet to much of Southwest Alaska. KDLG's Mike Mason was there and has the story.
1, 2, 3.
Local, state, and federal officials were joined by many local and state business leaders for Thursday's event, which was billed as a milestone event for GCI's Terra Southwest project. GCI and its subsidiary, United Utilities, were among the companies that received a huge boost through passage a few years ago of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Through the stimulus package, GCI was awarded $88 million to bring a terrestrial broadband internet network to the Bristol Bay and YK Delta regions. Currently, the region gets internet through satellite technology, which can often be slow and comes with latency issues that doesn't mesh very well with many of today's internet applications. $44 million of the total price tag of $88 million for the Terra Southwest project came through a grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Rural Utilities Service, which is under the direction of Jonathan Adelstein. He flew in from Washington, D.C. to attend Thursday's milestone event. Adelstein says a project like Terra Southwest couldn't be done without the stimulus money, and that money wouldn't have been forthcoming without leadership from Congress back in 2009.
And I get to come to these ribbon cuttings and take a little bit of credit for it, but it's really Congress and the brave elected officials that decided that this economy needed to have more jobs, that this economy needed to be running, and that needed to invest in the future.
During his speech, Adelstein specifically praised the leadership of Alaska's junior U.S. Senator Mark Begich in getting the stimulus funding through Congress. Begich flew into Dillingham to participate in Thursday's milestone event. Afterward, he defended his vote for the stimulus package. Begich was the only one of Alaska's delegation to Congress that voted for the package, which he says has since been politicized.
In Alaska, I think we had a great capacity to show off what we can do here and do it well, even under very extreme conditions. And I think this is one of those poster child programs where we get to go out there and say, you know what, we did it in the most extreme conditions, in the most remote areas of this country. And oh, by the way, we did it within the budget given to us, and we did it 2 years early.
Thursday's milestone event featured many local, state, and federal officials, but most of the enthusiasm was reserved for the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. Julius Jenikowski was making his first visit to Alaska. One of his main goals as the FCC chairman is to expand the nation's broadband infrastructure.
This will represent a dramatic improvement in the baseline ability to communicate with fast speeds over the internet. I think that this community will seize the opportunity, will see adoption of the technology by businesses and individuals, and will see real benefits.
Terra Southwest is a very large project that included above ground, underground, and seafloor fiber optic cables stretching from Homer to the small Bristol Bay village of Leavelock. The project then utilizes microwave technology bounced from tower to tower through Dillingham, Togiak, and Good News Bay until it reaches the existing network in the YK Delta known as DeltaNet. That network covers over 40 villages in the Delta as far north as Grayling. At Thursday's milestone event, GCI President and CEO Ron Duncan confirmed that GCI is actively planning to expand the Terra Southwest project to the Unalakleet area and even further.
Just last week, we signed a $5.3 million agreement with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to extend Terra Southwest from the Grayling site at the end of the network on north to Unalakleet on the northwest Alaska coast. We're working on securing financing for connecting Unalakleet to Nome and ultimately to build the network on up to Kotzebue and then over towards Bettles, where we could interconnect with our current fiber that runs along the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline, enabling us to close the ring and in the process double the capacity of the network.
Construction on the Terra Southwest project is scheduled to be done by the end of this year, and the network should go live in early 2012. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Kodiak is the number 3 fishing port in the country, and it wouldn't rank so high if it wasn't for the dedicated local processing workforce. That's the message sent to workers from the Kodiak City Council during last week's regular council meeting. KMXT's Maggie Wall has more.
The numbers are impressive. At least 1 in 4 Kodiak workers is employed in seafood processing. They handle roughly 330 million pounds of seafood annually, and 5 of the area's top 7 employers are processors. In recognition of the major impact seafood processing workers have on the community, the Kodiak City Council passed out certificates of recognition and bright red T-shirts. The shirts, distributed through participating processing plants, are part of an annual ritual to help processing workers feel special and appreciated. Because, as Councilman Saravia pointed out, they are.
Most of the times, maybe they not recognize how important they are or what kind of job they do for our city. But yeah, they do a real vital importance things, because if we don't have no country workers, maybe we don't have Coast Guard or very limited Coast Guard, or we never go be the second or third top fisheries port in the nation.
Saravia was the person who brought the annual Seafood Processing Workers' Day to Kodiak after seeing how well it worked in Cordova. Councilman John Whidden, manager at Island Seafoods, praised the workers on Cannery Row.
Just to say a few words about the folks that work on Shelikov Street and up and down that road, the Marine Way, that, as Charlie said, they're truly the lifeblood of our community and a lot of times unsung folks that don't get a lot of recognition, but without some of the really hard-working, dedicated professionals we have in the seafood industry, we wouldn't be here today. So,
a number of seafood workers were on hand to accept certificates to take back to the processing plants and to accept red T-shirts for themselves. I'm Maggie Wall.
The National Park Service is out with a final plan for managing off-road vehicle use on popular trails in Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. The plan and environmental impact statement cover trails in the northern part of the park and preserve along the Nebesna Road east of Glen Allen. Park Service planner Bruce Rogers says the documents reflect settlement of a lawsuit brought by environmental groups which questioned the agency's adherence to its own rules regarding consideration of the impacts before issuing permits for recreational off-road vehicle use.
Demonstrate that the use is compatible with park purposes and values, and the other part of it is that we have to do some level of compliance with the National Environmental Policy Act to consider the impacts of that activity. And so that's what we were challenged on, and we hadn't done those things.
Rogers says the plan calls for closure of three heavily damaged ATV trails off the Nebesna Road.
What we're proposing is that we will fix the degraded trails to a maintainable level, and then after that's done, we would permit the recreational off-road vehicle use on the improved trails in the National Preserve, but not in the park.
Roger says off-road vehicle use will still be permitted by qualified federal subsistence users on trails in the park and preserve and to access private land in holdings, rights mandated by the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. He says the trails will be monitored to ensure they don't degrade over time. The new plan also responds to demand for non-motorized trails. Rogers says the agency is looking at developing about 75 miles of non-motorized trails off the Nebesna Road. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Tim Ellis in Delta, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Maggie Wall in Kodiak, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Do you know a nonprofit executive or tribal leader who is at risk for job burnout? Nominate them for a Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical, which provides paid time away for personal renewal and growth. Go to Rasmussen.org for more information, but don't wait. Nominees must complete an application by October 1st. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.